This is the second day of this September 2018 two-day Sesshin. And since very shortly we'll be going back into the world, most of this talk will be about how do we take our practice off the mat for the other, whatever it is, 23 and a half hours, 18 hours, 10 hours, depending how much time one has in a day to sit. What happens to that practice? How do we sustain this? What is the purpose, really, of not just being here in this wonderfully supportive group, but going into the world? Also try to answer from other more wise people than myself some responses to things that people have brought up about how to get rid of thoughts, what to do with unconscious material that surfaces, and so forth. Now, if you've been practicing a long time and you have a nice, you're into your concentration really well, there's no need to listen to a word of this. You can just get back in there. And actually the same goes for anything. Just disregard what doesn't seem to mesh with the mind state you're currently in. I'll be using actually three sources. One from yesterday, Sandy Boucher on the turning the wheel in relation to women's practice with children and families. And I would actually expand that. When this book was written, men did not participate nearly as much in family life, taking equal shares. So where I put women, in many instances, it applies to guys as well. So that's the one source. The other is, again, my favorite, Russell Williams, partly because he's a fellow Brit, and he's 96, and he's a deeply, deeply awakened person, and he offers so much simple, wonderfully descriptive wisdom based on years of deep suffering. And there are people here who also share that level of deep suffering, and, you know, how do we work with that without going under? Well, I think the answer, we just actually recited it, although we do it by rote, Hakuin's chant and praise of Zazen, it's all in there. Everything that we focus on, work with, the gateway to freedom. Now, it doesn't say the gate to freedom, so there's no door to be open, there's no, 12-foot-high barrier to get through, it's just walking through. The gateway to freedom is Zazen Samadhi. And we throw the word Samadhi around, but what is Samadhi? Well, it's returning to the essential source. It's returning to our true nature. It's that stillness, that what we can experience it as empty stillness, but it's actually awareness, it's clarity. And this is the result of putting our minds absolutely on the one thing. This is the Zen way anyway, the one practice you have, whether it's the breath or the koan, and it takes us to that point. But awareness is always there. You can't escape it. It shuts down to like a little pinhole of light when we're really lost in our thoughts and suffering with emotional stress and so forth. But we can access it. And a useful thing, practice when we're out of a sesshin, is to keep returning to the awareness. Just find it. It's right there. You can't. It just needs attention. You just put your attention. And the whole of our practice really is about attention. So I have Russell, I have that. And then a very fairly popular Zen master who trained in Zen and then moved on to a more a different kind of inquiry practice, Ajahshanti. But he has some very helpful material about dealing with the unconscious stuff that arises during meditation. So I think maybe I'll start with him since it's the biggest piece of paper and I can get to it right away. He says, what do we do with unconscious material that rises to the surface? Nothing. We simply allow it to reveal itself. It does not need to be analyzed. What arises is, for the most part, unresolved conflict within us, emotions we've never allowed ourselves to experience fully, pains we've never allowed ourselves to feel fully. All of this arises. This unresolved material within us yearns to be experienced fully without being relegated to unconsciousness. So when our suppressed material arises, we need to allow it to arise without suppressing it, without analyzing. We allow these feelings to be experienced in the body, in our being, and to unfold as they will. To unfold as they will. What you'll find if you do this is that whatever kind of pain it is, whether emotional, psychic, physical, spiritual, or otherwise, this suppressed material will arise, reveal itself, be experienced, and then pass away. If it doesn't pass, you will know that somewhere there is resistance or denial or indulgence, which is a good thing to recognize because it gives the opportunity to let go of it once again. Meditation is the space where everything gets revealed, gets seen, everything gets experienced, and as such, it lets go of itself. What he's talking about here really is acceptance of what's going on. It's an important word. Accepting, if you give a present, in the acceptance of it, you're letting go and the other person is taking the gift. Resistance is to hang on to it. You keep, I'm not ready to give this up yet. I really am attached to this one. And we hang on tight. So acceptance is, the letting go, and this eventually comes to bring freedom. Now, what people find often is that there is a lot of very deeply suppressed material, partly because much of our suffering is experienced as little people, our little beings. So we only have a way of understanding it in the body, actually. A child may not have the mental thoughting yet developed, which is actually an advantage in one way, to understand what's going on. But a child feels. He feels intensely, or she feels intensely. And so these are registered within the being, and so the being has to allow it to let go. And one danger of Zen practice is that we do it in the head, trying to figure something out, to solve it, and we're really not fully present. The body and mind are one, not two. And so this also goes to how we respond to children. They can be just so aggravating, drive you insane. But how we respond, how we treat them, how we are fair with them, is going to stand them in good stead all through their lives. Doesn't have to be, you have to discipline, there has to be order, and children feel very unsafe if there's no kind of boundaries put on their life. I remember our son when he was about three, I would say, came totally alarmed by the garbage truck, the noise it made, and the, you know, and he would really be very upset by it. It was really, you know, fear coming in. And you just have to recognize sometimes with children they have huge fears, and, you know, addressing those is really helpful. So I'm going to now turn to Sandy Bush's thing on living together, the integration of Buddhist practice with family life, job, and community. One could easily devote a whole book to the discussion of the relationship of Buddhist practice to the rest of a woman or man's life. Here she's talking woman. Her responsibility to children and spouse or lover, her search for right livelihood, her experience of living with or otherwise relating to a particular sangha. Grappling with these issues is seen by many women as the essence of their practice. The changes which arise as women learn to coordinate practice with family responsibilities are crucial to the evolution of American Buddhism. For in better accommodating the needs of parents, Buddhist groups and centers will tap into a source of vital energy and humane direction and allow for the full flowering of female gifts within Buddhist experience. Of course, Zen grows out of a monastic tradition, so it is very, as it came to us from Japan, it has a hierarchical structure, it's very male-oriented. American life, because of our democratic process, is more towards a lay practice. Now, here in Rochester, we have a semi-monastic, which is how Roshi refers to it, a semi-monastic practice, but we also are supported fully by a sangha of people who work and live outside the center. So integrating, recognizing how those two things are intertwined is very important. The tension between monasticism and the demands of job and family arises in Buddhist centers as people test how best to manifest the heart of practice while honoring lay experience and responsibilities. Questions of relationships come up. Strict hierarchies exist in most centers, operating both to empower and to repress. The issue of how to manifest Buddhist practice in the earning of one's living absorbs many. Lesbians encounter mingled acceptance and prejudice in the groups with which they practice. Residents and participants in Buddhist centers are testing practice in the crucible of daily life and in the process shaping the direction of American Buddhism. Central to the process of the acceptance and evolution of Buddhism in this country is the experience of women with children. In this new practice that involves laywomen and families, Buddhist groups are finding ways to accommodate the needs of mothers, to honor the special experience they gain in nurturing small beings. While a common Buddhist prescription for the awakening of loving kindness is to think of all beings as one's children, in the actual practice of Buddhism in this country so far, the perspective of women with children has rarely been valued. Often by virtue of the structures, mothers have been denied access to formal training, have been forced to choose between their duties with their children and their spiritual quests. And then just to give a few examples of women talking about their situation. I'm talking with Laura Kwong at the tree-shaded Zen center headed by Jakusho Kwong, her husband, in the Yellow Hills outside Petaluma. She's a dynamic, articulate Chinese-American woman in her late 40s, whose pixie-cut hair frames a face both intelligent and kind. She says, "You know, for some people, motherhood comes real easy. For me, it didn't. I was afraid I was going to lose myself to being in this house, to being nothing but taking care of this baby. If there is Buddha nature in everything, what is there to lose, right? But it sure felt like I was going to lose something. But anyway, I trusted it. Suzuki Roshi said, Buddha nature is everywhere. So I felt I have to remember that, and I'm going to test to see it is so. So then I gradually learned how to do it. Not meaning I learned how to do the household things. I learned how to give up my idea of self. Not for this baby, not for this husband, but to give up so that there's something else that comes up to take care of this matter. That was my first experience, learning how to give up the self. Practice is kind of really vital here, because what she was able to tap into was allowing her Buddha nature to arise, and her functioning was without thinking about it all the time, because obviously when she thought about it, she could have become really aggravated, but instead she was just doing, and it sort of worked somewhat. Although with several babies and a part-time job, she was not able to attend many sesshins, Laura did get up to sit in the morning and found this, along with other directed activities, valuable. She said, "Practice, meaning some kind of spiritual foundation and meditation, was very important in how I was able to have a family. I felt like I did a lot of mindful practice, like going to work, being with the kids. Now I do this, now I do that, moment after moment. If it were not for that, it would have been horrendous. When I was 21 years old with one baby, I could hardly go to the store because I couldn't think straight, couldn't focus. But because of sitting in that feeling of being present, or living my life completely wherever I am, it helped me to just take care of the babies, take care of the house, do the cleaning with that feeling of devotion. And it became very easy because of that." Then we go to Sylvia Kincaid, who lives at the Zen Center, and she is responsible for gardens and things. But when she was much younger, she lived nearby the center, worked at a job, and raised her children. And she tells how she managed that. It's also maybe helpful to think of our mothers, because there's certainly mothers here who are currently dealing with this, but I'm old now, and how did my mother cope with four kids and, so some of this hearing about these stories can help us understand maybe a little bit of what our parents, our mothers and fathers really struggled with. She says, this is our friend Sylvia, "I have two daughters, and I was raising them alone and having to work outside and take care of the family and also come to the center," she laughs. "All at the same time, I was just determined that wherever I was would be practice. At my work, that would be practice. At home, it would be practice. And here, it would be. So it didn't matter if I was here or not, but something kept bringing me here. Also, that same something asked me to take care of my life, which was going to work, cleaning my house, washing the dishes, taking care of the yard. When I was supporting my daughters, I mostly worked as a waitress because I could make more money doing that." So here you see, you could look at right livelihood. What is it? Well, for her, right livelihood was earning enough money to take care of her children. I think that's true for many families, that whoever's working, they're doing that job to earn money to take care of their family. It's a giving. It's not, regardless of the job, I mean, as long as it's not, evil and doing things that are unwholesome. "So, in order to bring the practice into that, I thought of it as serving, just serving without expecting anything. It made the job wonderful. I was happy to be there and happy to do it. It was the same feeling as at the Zendo, serving. You don't actually bow, but you feel the bow when you're serving." Of course, she also had the challenge that her husband was a Roshi, and she had to figure that out too, which was, as she said, was her koan. every day. Sometimes I'm yelling at the husband. Sometimes I'm bowing to the teacher. Sylvia and I laugh as Laura warms to her subject, straight-faced now, but with sparkling eyes. I'm never bowing to my husband. I always scold my husband, and then I bow to the teacher. I have to keep that straight. Finally, she herself begins to sputter with laughter, and she adds, "Sometimes I scold the teacher," and we all lean forward. "I used to have a very difficult time," she says. "I have a sense of humor about it now because I think I have it pretty clear that this situation was given to me for some reason. I do believe there's a reason for whatever is given to you in our perfect universe. I used to think of it as such a problem, but now I decide how to use it and not become the passive victim of other people's projections." When you have kids, it's the same. I mean, it's a problem, right? Then pretty soon you say, "Hey, listen, I've got 4 kids for some reason." So you get up and decide to do something instead of be in that state of being victimized. I think most of us who have any experience with depression know that depression is a state of the spirit unable to move. You're just stuck. And the antidote really is action. It's doing something for somebody else is enormous. Because when you really do something for somebody else, where are you? This self that's suffering, it's gone. It's not there. The self is this, it's like a whole series of little movie frames, you know, but it's not what's the projection, it's not the source. So if, you know, sometimes it takes medication, serious depression is not something to be pull up your socks and get on with, it's not that, but if you can bring yourself to act, to do your best, that's all we can do. And we'll fail over and over again. In Zen practice, actually, we get practice in failure. I mean, have you ever been called on by Roshi, something you didn't play quite right, or whatever it is? Because that's part of the training practice of learning to hear no, learning to have some resilience. And just, if you've done your best, what else can you do? Except maybe you look at your mistakes and you change instead of holding on to them, you know. Keeping the emotional baggage out is really good. Anyway, that is those two ladies. The third one is Jan Chosen Bays, who's been here with the AZTA, the American Zen Teachers Association, and she is she was married to Sonia Colheed's first husband. That's complicated, but there is a connection to here. She's been here very she's a pediatrician and also a Roshi. So she started at the Los Angeles Zen Center, and she said, now she's older, okay, so this is the reflection. "One thing I feel now is that I wish I had spent more time with my children when they were growing up. In my very intense drive to go into Buddhism as deeply as I could, to practice in a traditional way, I really feel I missed something with the kids. Now I'm trying to make it up. I don't feel horribly guilty about it. It was what happened. My children, interestingly, do not feel they were neglected." So it's not necessarily giving your kids, you know, so much attention. It's that when you're with them, you're fully with them. That's the only thing. You're reflecting, you're a mirror for them, what they're bringing forth. Not what you're throwing out, what they're bringing forth, and you're totally with them. So 10 minutes of that in a day is worth 3 hours of trying to read your email on your device, trying to answer the phone, make supper, and do all the things. They don't need so much. They just need to feel that when you're with them, you're right there. "I do feel," she goes on, For a few years, I really did neglect my family. I don't know if I would do it again. I probably would. And that's a really important thing, you know. You think, oh God, I feel so guilty about doing whatever that was. And then you ask that question. Well, if it came up again, how would I do it? 9 times out of 10, you might do the same thing over and over. So, as she says, in Japan, and this would be true in India also, I believe, if you have children, you wait until they're all gone and you're 80, and then, and you're 80, and then you enter the nunnery. But I was too impatient to do that. This drive was too strong within me, and so I had to plunge in. Now, there they resolved it by having 3 families with children, and then they would trade off. And that's, I hope, something that we can support our younger Sangha members' families more in future, so that the sitting can become part of it. Well, for sure, I think most of our children that do come, at least to Chapin Mill, they regard this as this is the children's Zen center. Forget the rest of you, it's theirs. So this is really good. So that is just all I have really for, you know what? That's good, that's enough. And so then I'm just going to go to Russell, because he has some really helpful advice. He's talking here about unsatisfactory situations within oneself. So he says, unsatisfactory situations within oneself are the cause of everything. If we knew precisely who or what we were, we would be content with that. We wouldn't want to go anywhere, and we wouldn't need to pursue any ambitions. If you are content, would you do anything in particular? So, we're not wholly content, and that's why we pursue other things to alleviate it. Discontent is the ruling factor behind our activity. Unfortunately, since we don't see it very clearly, all we know is that we're not very comfortable, and something else looks more comfortable, so we go and chase that, or we possess it, and hope that we'll feel better. Perhaps we do for a little while, but since we have taken our discomfort to the new situation, it turns to discomfort as well. So that becomes the whole of our life. The whole point is to eliminate those factors that cause the dissatisfaction, which, truly speaking, is our concept of duality. For example, I am lonely, therefore I need some company. I'm not whole, there's something missing in my life. As I already mentioned, there's nothing missing in your life. It was always there. You just never saw it. You looked into duality instead of the fullness of wholeness itself. So what he's trying to, I think, get is for us to move more into our awareness, actually. He calls it consciousness. It exists in several different dimensions at once, one of which is the physical world. I live in these dimensions, not just in the physical plane. Consciousness is continually widening its expanse. One becomes more and more conscious, but not as an individual. Ultimately, there is no self-consciousness and no self. The only reality is consciousness itself with no separation. When a person meditates deeply, they lose awareness of the body and become part of this expanse of consciousness. They become aware that what they thought was their own consciousness is a part of consciousness itself. It's always assumed that thinking is consciousness, but if this is true, How do you know when you're thinking thoughts you don't want to think? If you look at the nature of that which is looking, it is quite serene and unconcerned. Looking at something which is chaotic, the two natures are different. Consciousness and thoughts are not the same. In a state of anxiety, consciousness contracts so much that it becomes nothing. In moments of peace and contentment, it expands so much that it becomes everything. My mind is empty all the time. I think if I need to, otherwise I don't. I just enjoy the beauty of experience. When you think, your senses close down. If you think intently, you stop hearing, you stop seeing. When you stop thinking, the world becomes intensely real and beautiful. There may sometimes be difficulties, but there are no worries. Even difficulties are simple if you look at them clearly. Strangely, it appears that if one is able to clear the mind, which is of course what we do in Zazen, and have no knowledge whatsoever, the mind will respond immediately without thinking, and it is capable of doing that with no planning or forethought. It always responds effectively and appropriately. Silence is at the heart of everything. In mechanical terms, it's like a spinning wheel as it moves up and down and around. There's the point in the middle which doesn't move. So I think our task is to bring more awareness, paying attention to everything we do, bringing more awareness into the time we're not on the mat. If this practice does not transfer into our everyday life, it's a failure. So, but there's no big stick in this. We just relax into the awareness, which is so pure and will bring. It does bring the peace of mind that we all wish. We'll stop here now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow